We are at the Four Seasons Biltmore in Santa Barbara. This is the Stem Cell Research and Aging meeting of the Paul Glenn Symposium on the Biology of Aging. We're with Anne Chang, who's from Stanford School of Medicine. You work actually in the Cancer Center, you do dermatology. And your talk, very interestingly, was about the identification of genes promoting exceptional skin youthfulness. I would have thought with all the magazines out there on the stands, you'd be much in demand. I mean, people want to look youthful all the time. I mean, but you have a more serious story to tell. Could you start explaining that some of it to me?
Yes. So what I'm most interested in is the human genetics of skin aging and how do we promote healthy aging of the skin with the sort of unprecedented aging of the worldwide population. How can we keep the skin from losing its elasticity, thinning out, losing, oil glands, et cetera, to promote healthy skin and maintain. It has to stay healthy to keep up with the newfound longevity.
So you're not talking about just a silly cosmetic perspective. You're talking about the functional aspects of
how do we maintain good function, the skin being our primary or one of the main barriers to our environment, barrier against infection or physical insults, that sort of thing.
It just occurs to me that skin is one of those things that there's advice out there all the time. Don't go in the sun, don't do this, melanoma, blah 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 blah. There's something far more, as you were just alluding to there, mm-hmm. something far more fundamental about it as a as an organizing structure. So how, in fact, what do you know about how to keep this a youthful and elastic environment in which we live? I mean.
We know that there are people who are in advanced age, such as centenarians, and so my research is using a population in collaboration with Nir Barzilai at Albert Einstein. Yeah. We know that there are centenarians who, despite all the common physical insults to the skin, such as ultraviolet light exposure, smoking, etc., they still have really skin that appears decades younger than their chronological age. So we're trying to identify what are the genetic pathways that might promote this healthy skin, that's what my talk is about.
Yeah, when I talked to Neil last time, it was quite clear from his study that these people are not doing they're not health freaks, they're not doing something very special.
Right.
They in fact inflict all kinds of assaults on themselves.
Right.
Smoking, drinking, all those sorts of things. But if underlying that, therefore, is a genetic story, mm-hmm. how is that translatable into a practical remediation for other people who don't have those genes? I mean, or do we just have to sit here and say, well, they're lucky, well, I'm not?
Oh, I see. We're still very far away from identifying the function of these genes and gene pathways that could be found. There may be pathways out there that we have never necessarily thought of or focused on. Currently there are FDA-approved medications such as tretinoin, which help with the appearance of skin and to decrease the appearance of wrinkles. But, that is sort of that's just one pathway. Basically, we have to uncover what might be promoting good skin before we can even talk about pharmaceutical agents or topical agents that might help with that. You could alter those pathways perhaps with chemicals, molecules, drugs.
But what is your take on As I said, you pick up any magazine,
mm-hmm.
women's magazines particularly, and there's a new issue that says, here's somebody who had some terrible plastic surgery, here's somebody who's using too much Botox, here's somebody... a lot of these things are about skin mm-hmm. and popular treatments out there
right.
for making skin appear more youthful. Mm-hmm. How much of that is accurate in your view, and how much of it is...
So I'm a dermatologist.
How much of it is just skin deep? Sorry.
Yeah, no. As a dermatologist, we view the skin as a window into the underlying medical conditions that a person can have. So there's a number of skin conditions that you can see that are signs that you may have an autoimmune disease or an underlying cancer.
Right.
My angle is not just how it looks, but it also has to be healthy. Free of skin cancers, free of inflammation, and that's what my research is focused on.
All right. So do you remember when this all began for you? I mean, did you have parents who were scientists? Did you have a teacher? Was there some event that happened that made you think, I want to go into medicine?
No, I mean, it was more of a process. I think that in college, I didn't think that I necessarily would become a doctor. I think that I tried different things. So, for instance, I did research in a cellular biology lab.
But why science in the first place?
So what I liked about it is that you could make new discoveries that other people could use. It was very usable, and it could also be of help to people in sort of a concrete way. Instead of historical field or, something where you're just studying what other people have done, you're actually adding to it. So it's very dynamic.
Yeah. And this particular specialty, I mean, how did you navigate to this?
Yeah, I mean, I think for a doctor that wants to do research, the skin is a very ideal organ because it's visible. It's something everyone can see. You can quantitate it, and people care about how the skin looks. So that is one reason that I went into dermatology.
But just going back to that point I was making earlier, mm-hmm. I mean, do you have a perspective on all those Botox ads and all those sorts of things? I mean, do you think that that's a healthy kind of thing for people to be doing from your perspective as a professional dermatologist?
I think people are free to choose. Given all the information that's out there, they can decide for themselves if that's something they want. So I really believe that people are able to make their own decisions are free to gather as much or as little information as they want. So I don't have a global view on that.
Right. But one of the things that we do on the Science Network, obviously, uh-huh. is we talk about it, stuff at the intersection of science and social policy. So we think uh-huh. that science communication is important.
Yes.
To the extent that I think that scientists have an obligation
uh-huh.
to explain what they're doing.
I see.
Would you agree with
so,
that?
So, yeah. I mean, I think that your question goes more towards, being a doctor. You know, a doctor's job is to explain what is known or presently available information to the patient, to sort of interpret that in a way that's easily understandable. But I think being a scientist is different. Being a scientist is... you're actually creating things that are not necessarily, there's nothing established about it yet. You have to understand where the history is that led to where the current knowledge is, but you don't necessarily you don't interpret data that's already out there.
Well, but don't you work in both fields, though? I mean, I, as I told you, yesterday we spoke to Hinko Gierman, and he's working on in some collaboration with you. He knew about near Basilized population, but he also has this other population of people who are over 110, and also have this skin that's like. He was saying they look like 70-year-olds or something.
Yeah. No, I haven't looked at those skins.
But there's some fundamental research. But he's collaborating with you, so you're actually doing both things, aren't you? I mean, it's not just simply sort of taking a scientist's data and
I don't think
I'll now take it into my to my patients.
Yeah, I mean, I think that being a scientist is a little different than being a doctor. So, for instance, you know, I don't think it's good idea to discuss things that are, well, it's good to discuss what's unknown, but you have to clearly label it as such. You know, it's research, it's not accepted. We don't know a lot about this or that. You know, I think it can be dangerous to use ongoing research to treat your patients. You know, that's not, that you have to have that line defined in your mind. When you do both, you know, clinical care and research.
Clinical trials, FDA approved, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, I think that, you know, I think doctors are portrayed very well in the media. You know, there's a lot of TV shows out there that, you know, portray doctors in a favorable light, but there aren't very many that portray the lives of scientists. So I think that, you know...
but that's an interesting point.
Yeah.
No, there are not many television series about scientists. The only one I could think of is Lie to Me, which was basically using Paul Ekman's work and talking about deception and so on. There are, as you say, many medical shows. I mean, House, Grey's Anatomy. I can't even remember all of these things. But they are very dramatic.
Yes.
Right? They're dramas.
Yes.
So are we saying that the life of a doctor is full of drama and that the life of a scientist is just boring at the bench?
No, I don't think it is at all. I think that... you know, what you're doing is a good way to try to bridge what the scientists do and making it accessible or understandable to general population. I think that's really important, and there needs to be more of that.
Do you watch any of those TV series like House and
Rosie? No, I don't.
Okay.
It's too much like going to work.
Oh, okay. So you think that the daily life of a physician, a medical person, is actually as full of drama as those things are?
I don't know. I don't watch them.
Okay. All right. So, when you started in science, medicine, what was the best advice you got? Or alternative, if you want to do it another way, what's the best advice you would give to a young scientist?
Advice I would give to any young person, whether they're a scientist or not, would be to try a lot of different things while you're young.
Yeah.
To figure out what not only you're good at, but what do you enjoy and what is sustainable over decades, and that can change. But also to know your limitations. I think that, you know, everybody has limitations, and the way to succeed is to know those limitations and seek out people who can help you or fill in those gaps that you are not necessarily so strong at.
So a good mentor is a... important.
A good mentor, but also, you know, people that you work with in your research group, you know, people who have expertise in certain aspects that of your research that you, you know, one person can't know everything. So,
so Talk to me if do you have any sense of any feelings about the relationship of science to society? I mean, when he took office, President Obama said that his administration would restore science to its rightful place. Mm-hmm. Didn't say where that was. What is the rightful place of science?
I think that I'm going to back up a little bit. So, my parents came to the United States from Taiwan in their 20s. The reason they came here was because the education system and the research system here was so developed. Sort of in their view, it was like no other in the world.
Right.
So I think that, you know, even when I go to conferences, I notice that even though most of the labs may be American labs, they're filled with people from all over the world,
right.
And so whether it's Europe, Asia, or anywhere else. So I think that it's a paragon, an international sort of model that everyone recognizes as the most highly developed and productive. So in my mind, that is one of the most unique things about America and should be supported and continued in the future.
When you talk about the power of a well-developed scientific society, as I sat through these talks over the last couple of days, one thing that struck me was how you convey all this to a general audience. I mean, these talks were extraordinarily specific.
Mm-hmm.
It was deeply detailed research.
Mm-hmm.
But how you managed to sort of ask people whether, in fact, they are in touch with, and I would have thought this would be true for people who are doctors like yourself, the fact that we've got 75 million people coming along, baby boomers, who are, just a huge population, very expensive, going to have lots of, age degenerative diseases. Do you think about that context? Do you think that that one of the enormous powerful services that a scientist can provide is to sort of find ways of diminishing what currently are very painful exit strategies that people have? Tedious, long diseases. How do you maintain a healthy lifespan? Are these things that concern you?
Oh, yes. I mean, I see that every day in my general dermatology practice. You know, most of the skin diseases I see, I'm an adult dermatologist, are in people over 65, you know, whether it's skin cancers, benign skin conditions like seborrheic dermatitis, psoriasis. Those are all increased with age. That's part of why I do the research that I do. It started as I was of a clinical person mainly, but the answers that we can get just simply by looking at clinical parameters actually is limited. We need to dig deeper. We need to look at understanding biology. So that wasn't something that I started doing right off the bat, but being proximal to Stanford and to basic scientists knowing some of them, enabled me to tap into that resource to try to understand how we can get at these better understanding of promoting skin health on a molecular level. I think if more people, more lay people, had an interest or understood the healthcare issues at hand and sort of what is possible scientifically now, that would help to define or what is important for the population, and it would be valued by more people. So I think sort of what you're doing now to sort of bring scientific sort of leading edge, make it more accessible is really important.
Yeah, because Mark Collins was saying the other day that although there were people working, you know, presenting these papers, there was no sort of real growing philosophy of the biology or you know, the sense of the biology of aging and how and what's going to really hit us very, very soon. You can read poets and playwrights mm-hmm. talking about death and so on and so forth, but we don't have a scientific narrative of decline. We don't seem to have anything yet which would make the inevitable less fearful for people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what people are looking for in this, is how does this research lead to a situation in which the prospect of the years of decline mm-hmm. goes away, and maybe this is just a pipe dream. I've no idea. Maybe, you know, meetings like this, all you folks working in this area, will end up with a situation in which people simply just live a healthy lifespan and then just expire briefly. Mm-hmm. Is that too much to ask for?
No, I don't think so. I think that, well, this is a new relatively new phenomenon in sort of the history of mankind, that we're able to control to some extent the disease course of chronic diseases. So, you know, I think we're just beginning to tap into that. Yeah. You know, maybe not in this generation, but several generations down the road, yeah. that would become more common. The yeah. sort of supposed ideal way to end that yeah. you just talked about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Were you interested in the history of science much and medicine?
Not that much. Well, I am starting to read a biography on History of Cancer, which is a great book by one of my medical school classmates, Siddhartha Mukherjee.
I knew Siddhartha,
That's a wonderful book, and I'm learning a lot just by reading it.
Yeah.
So here's the last question. What are you optimistic about?
So I'm optimistic that there are people who are committed to science and will, you know, persevere in the face of, very tough circumstances, whether it's financial challenges, you know, scientific challenges. I believe that will continue. Basically, whether it occurs quickly or not so quickly depends on on these external factors, you know, funding being a main one. So that's what I'm optimistic about.
What would be, could you describe a situation where you would feel so satisfied that you had achieved your aims in your job?
Mm-hmm.
Is there some plateau of discovery that you think you would yeah. make you ecstatic about having been working in this field?
Well, let's see. You know, if there was some way to cheaply and easily detect or predict who was going to get certain diseases in the skin and otherwise, thereby heading it off, making it not happen, avoiding expensive or very invasive treatments, that would be wonderful. You know, I think that one of the things about being a scientist is that you're never satisfied. You never look back and say, okay, I've done enough. I think that it's just part of the inner core of people who are scientists to continually work towards improvement. So I don't think that there is an end point, and that science and people are constantly evolving. So,
yeah. All right. Well, good luck in your work.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're welcome.